Thanks for downloading this podcast. There are hundreds more just like it at abc.net.au/conversations, and we're on iTunes as well.
How's that?
I think
one day I feel so.
Well, look, thank you.
Now, what would be my story if that were the case?
Oh, no. So, that's not what I meant.
You can, but I can't answer it.
And it's, there was this indescribable welter of emotions.
I think
to this day,
I will never accept
it. It was
that.
Like something that
never
just sort of snapped in my head.
And
look, I don't know. It's a miracle.
And I hope that the people listening to us will enjoy what they hear.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations, coming to you live from the Brisbane Writers Festival here at the State Library of Queensland in front of an audience which feels like 500,000 enthusiastic book readers and people here for a good time. Welcome to you all. There's an amazing story behind today's guest today, and it begins in 1960. In 1960, a Nazi war criminal called Adolf Eichmann was put on trial in Israel for crimes against humanity. As people watched the Eichmann trial on TV all over the world, they asked themselves, how could this ordinary schlub of a man do such terrible things? In fact, how was it that so many ordinary people were able to take part in such monstrous crimes, to drive those trains, to build those camps, to guard those fences? Just after Eichmann was executed, they got their answer. And the answer came from a series of psychological experiments from Yale University called the Milgram Experiments. A large group of volunteers were paid $4.50 to participate in what they were told was a learning experiment. The volunteers were instructed by an authority figure to ask questions to a man in a chair in another room. If that man gave an incorrect answer, the volunteer was instructed to administer an electric shock, a shock that got higher each time. The results were astonishing, and they created an international sensation. They showed that 65%, nearly two-thirds of people, of the volunteers, were prepared to give a lethal dose of electricity to the helpless person in the other room, beyond the point when that person had stopped screaming and was apparently dead. Of course, there was no electricity, and the person screaming from the other room was just an actor. The man behind these experiments was called Stanley Milgram, and the conclusion of his experiments seemed to be, there's just something in human nature that wants to obey, and most of us are capable of doing terrible things if we're directed to do it by a man in a lab coat or a uniform. Gina Perry is with me at the moment. Gina is a psychologist who's got a long and deep fascination with the Milgram experiments. Her own research, though, shows that there was much more to Milgram and his experiments than most of us realise, and also that similar experiments were done right here in Australia. Gina Perry wrote a book about it called Behind the Shock Machine, The Untold Story of the Notorious Milgram Psychology Experiments. Ladies and gentlemen, Gina Perry. Gina, please now take me through the baseline study, the one I kind of just sketched the outline for there. Just take me through it through the eyes of one of the volunteers, the people who volunteered for it, the volunteer who answered the ad asking for people to show up. What happened when they did show up for the experiments?
Well, they would arrive at the lab at a particular time that they'd been given when they phoned after they'd seen the ad in the newspaper, and they'd be met by a man in a lab coat, and there'd also be someone else waiting there at the lab who was someone else, supposedly, who'd also responded to the ad in the paper, who just happened to get there a little bit earlier. And those two volunteers would draw lots for the role of teacher and learner, and they'd be told that the experiment was about memory and learning. And the person who got the piece of paper that said teacher was the person who was going to be teaching the learner words pairs, so pairs of words like blue ball, yellow fence, green dog. I'm simplifying them, but that you get the idea. And each time what they would do then would be read the word pairs to the learner in the other room via a microphone. Then, once that period was over, they would actually test the learner's memory. So they would read one word of the word pair, and the learner would have to give the second word that matched that first one. They were told that each time the learner gave an incorrect answer, They were to administer an electric shock.
Now, what was the machine that gave the electric shock?
Well, it was a large generator, a machine sitting on a table in front of the teacher, and it had a row of 30 switches on the machine. Each switch had a voltage level specified underneath. So the first switch started at 15 volts and it went up in 15 volt increments to 450 volts. So each time the learner gave a wrong answer, the teacher had to move one step up on the machine and give the next level of shock.
Were there labels above the volts explaining the kind of the intensity of the dose?
Yes, each group of switches would have a descriptive label, so it might start with mild shock and then it would move through to severe, and then eventually the final group of switches were labelled danger XXX.
Danger XXX. Meaning of that is pretty clear, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Please note my hesitation
there.
Yeah,
I do. Now, had the volunteer who was going to be the teacher in this, had he been given a taste of that electricity?
Yes. Most of the people who got the job of teacher were asked to take a sample shock just to feel what the voltage would feel like for the learner in the room next door. And they were given a sample voltage of about 45 volts, which was the third switch on the machine. And a couple of people I spoke to described it as an unpleasant tingle.
Now, of course, what that person didn't know was that the learner was an actor. How did they manage to get it so that the actor, the volunteer would be the teacher and that the actor would be the learner?
Well, each time they were given the pieces of paper with teacher and learner on them, supposedly, both pieces of paper actually said teacher, so that always the naive volunteer, that is the real person, would always get the job of teacher when they arrived at the lab.
When they were brought into the lab there and put in front of the shock machine, there was the person there with them. What was he wearing? What did he look like, this professor or this unnamed academic figure?
He wore a grey lab coat. Physically, he was tall, very thin and quite stern-looking. And he introduced himself as Mr. Williams, and he was the experimenter. So in the experiment, there was the experimenter, the teacher, and the learner. And the experimenter stayed in the room with the teacher while the teacher went through this supposed memory experiment.
Typically, how were these volunteers recruited? Where were they? What kind of range of society were they drawn from?
Well, Milgram advertised the experiment in the local newspaper, the New Haven Register, and he distributed the ads throughout the paper, particularly in the sports pages. He was looking for people in the local community, average people, not university students. Up until that time, university students had comprised the largest groups of subjects in psychological experiments, and he really wanted to bring in people off the street. When he didn't get a huge response to his first advertisements, he then went to the telephone directory and started systematically taking people's names and addresses from the telephone directory and writing them a letter asking them to take part in an experiment at Yale and really encouraging them and flattering them, I guess, in the letter that they would be part of something important and useful.
Men and women?
Initially men only, but as the experiments continued, Milgram did go with one condition, with a group of women.
So typically once he brought someone in, the volunteer who's discovered that he's a teacher, he sits down in front of the shock machine and the learner, really an actor, is in the other room. How would the experiment typically proceed from there?
Well, the teacher would sit in front of the shock machine with a microphone. He would read out a single word and the learner would reply by pressing a button, and there was a little box on top of the shock machine that had numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, and the learner's answer would light up. So if they thought the first word was the right one, then number 1 would light up. If they thought the second option they were given was the right word, they'd press 2, three or four. And then the teacher would say that answer is either correct or incorrect. Tell them the right answer if it was incorrect, and then tell them the voltage they're about to give them and press the switch.
So they begin by getting the first couple correct, and then there could be something wrong.
Yes.
A small dose is administered with a flick of a switch.
Yes.
And then what would typically happen once more incorrect answers came in?
Around 70 volts, which was about the fifth switch, the fifth switch, the teacher would hear the learner make a noise. Until that time, the only time the teacher heard the learner was when the learner was giving answers. But at this, about this sixth switch point, he would hear the learner give a kind of a grunt in response to the shock. And that was the first time that the teacher would hear that there was some physical impact of the shock on the person in the room next door.
And as it went further up the scale?
Those sounds became louder and more explicit, so that by about 120 volts, which would have been about another five switches on, the learner would be protesting loudly about the pain and saying they wanted to be set free, out of the experiment.
Often at that point, the teacher would show some qualms. The teacher would go, should I do this? I'm not sure. This isn't sounding right. What would the experiment, the man in the lab coat, then say?
Each time the teacher indicated that they were hesitating or didn't want to continue, the experimenter would give a standard response. And the first one was, you must continue.
And then once there was a problem after that and the teacher complained again?
The next prod would be, the experiment requires that you continue. The third one was, you must continue, teacher, you must go on. And then the fourth prod was, you have no other choice, you must continue.
As the voltage got higher and higher and towards that XXX mark, the screams would get louder and louder. And was there a point where they just stop?
Yes, at around 375 volts, the person, after screaming very loudly, would suddenly go quiet. And again, there was that situation with the teacher not quite knowing what was happening, because the experimenter would say, treat silence as a wrong answer and continue to give the shocks.
And we know that 65% of people in those conditions, in that baseline experiment, continued to administer shocks to the learner past the point where they remained silent.
Yes, to 450 volts, which was the last switch on the machine.
Two out of every three people in this case. What would happen when the experiment was done, typically? What was the volunteer then told?
Typically, they were told that whether they'd continued to the end or even if they'd broken off, typically they were reassured that whatever decision they'd made was quite normal, that they were in the same situation that a nurse might be in, where they were forced, as part of their role in a hospital, to give jabs to protesting patients. So their behaviour was very much normalised in an attempt to make people feel less disturbed and less stressed at the end of the experiment. And often they were told that actually the machine wasn't as powerful as they'd been led to believe. That even though it had the labels on it that it had, that it had actually been developed for use with small animals. So danger, severe shock, didn't mean the same when you were giving the shock to a small animal as you would a human.
What happened when the results were published? What was the effect of Milgram publishing these reports?
The results were published in an academic journal, and they were quickly picked up by the media, and it just went around the world. It was just shocking news. People felt horrified, appalled, fascinated, but it absolutely made the headlines. So overnight, he went from being a completely unknown professor at Yale to someone who had a degree of fame and controversy.
It was kind of brought out, the results came out at a time when candid camera had just come to TV, hadn't it? There was a kind of prank culture that was there on television, pranks that revealed some interesting things about human psychology. Did it kind of feed into that culture a bit?
Milgram was a big admirer of Candid Camera. It was a very popular TV show in the US in the 1950s and into the 60s. He felt that it offered an insight into humans, that you could learn a lot about people by studying them covertly. So by hiding cameras and recording them without them knowing, you could find out interesting things about people that they wouldn't otherwise reveal about themselves.
One of my favourite pranks they had on Candid Camera, I've seen this from the 1960s, they'd have someone get into a lift and everyone would be facing the back of the lift instead of the doors. And the camera would then show this person being the only person facing the doors, and eventually, inevitably, they'd turn around. It's not a million miles different from this kind of thing, is it? It's a lot less grim, though, a lot more fun. How were you introduced to the Milgram experiments? Where does this fascination begin with you, Gina?
I studied psychology at La Trobe University as my undergraduate degree, and I arrived in a psychology degree almost by accident, and I was finding it quite difficult. It was very scientific, very dry, very statistical, lots of rats and brains and cannulas and all sorts of things that I didn't expect and wasn't enjoying. And I remember vividly hearing a lecture where the lecturer talked about the Milgram experiment, and that was the first time I think I realised that there was a whole world of interesting things that psychology could be doing. So I did feel kind of inspired and excited by it. I remember that feeling vividly.
Sometime in the mid-2000s, I think, you wrote you were wanting to write an article about Stanley Milgram and the Milgram experiments for a national newspaper, and there was no interest. And then that changed. What changed that?
Well, there was no interest because Stanley Milgram had been dead for a long time, and a lot of editors were saying, well, you know, what's the interest? So there's no big deal. But Abu Ghraib, the story of the torture there broke, and Milgram's name was in the news all over again because people use the Milgram experiment as a ready illustration of what people will do in certain circumstances when they're commanded to do things that are in conflict with what we would regard as our morals or our conscience.
So there was suddenly a lot more interest, and that's when you picked up the scent a bit more. Once you found out more about the Milgram experiments, the more you looked into it, what was the big question for you that remained unanswered?
The big question for me always with the Milgram experiments was what happened to the people afterwards. I mean, I was interested in Milgram, the man. I did want to know more about him, but I was, for me, that story just finished way too soon in those psychology textbooks. It talked about the number of people who went to maximum voltage, and then it moved on to a discussion of what that might mean, whereas I was back with the person sitting in front of the machine. I really wanted to know how they dealt with it. What did they go home and say to their families? How did they talk to people about what they'd done? How did they feel? So,
guess what I found out about myself today, honey? I'm no better than a Nazi death camp guard.
Well, yeah, some people felt that way, but yeah, so that was really what I was interested in.
Who was this man, Stanley Milgram?
He arrived at Yale about 6 months before the experiments began. It was his first professional position after his postgraduate training. He did a PhD with a famous social psychologist called Solomon Asch, who also explored the whole issue of what makes people conform to fit in with a group in particular. So he was a very ambitious young man. He'd been born in New York, a Jewish family. His parents had been very concerned during the war about relatives in Europe. He had relatives who came and stayed with the family in New York at the end of the war who'd come from a concentration camp. So he was a very bright young man, very ambitious, and did his PhD at Harvard, then did his research in Europe, and he arrived at Yale as an untenured associate professor. So the bottom of the academic ladder, probably very conscious that he had to make his mark and establish himself and create some kind of reputation, and quickly.
There was a kind of whole streak of Jewish popular culture in America in the 1960s about They couldn't seem to be able to talk about the Holocaust up front, but they were asking the question all the time, and even in sitcoms and comic books and lots of things like, what the hell just happened 20 years ago? Why did people do this? Could it happen here? That was kind of like a meme, if you want to use that horrible word, that was floating through American culture in the 1960s. Did Milgram ever describe those test subjects, the volunteers that were brought in? Did he ever liken them to Nazis?
Oh, absolutely, yes. In fact, the first journal article that was published about his research just focused on the first experiment in the series, and there were 24. And in that first journal article, he talked about death camps in the first paragraph. Another reason I think it was so sensational and so picked up by the media.
Now, most people are aware of the baseline experiment, the first one which we just went through, but as you just pointed out, there are a whole lot of variations that he conducted on this experiment. Like any good scientist would do, he conducted variations to see what other data could come through it. What can you tell me about some of those variations? How did he change it? How did he switch it round?
Well, each variation had 40 people, so it is worth bearing in mind when we talk about 65% in Milgram's experiments, we're talking about 65% of 40 people, which is, I think, 26. So each variation tested different elements of obedience and how you could shape it and get more or less. So, for example, if you brought the learner into the room with the teacher so the teacher could hear them and see them, people were less likely to go to 450 volts. If you brought the learner into the room and made the teacher put the learner's hand on a metal plate in order to get the shock, fewer people obeyed. If you put the teacher with two other supposed teachers, so there would be three teachers and one learner, and the other two teachers rebelled, the third teacher would rebel and refuse to continue. So Milgram was looking at what factors influence whether people will go to 450 volts and obey an authority figure, and what things will change that.
One other thing that's not clear from the experiments until you see the footage of it, and this is candid camera again, isn't it? The footage of some of the volunteers is how much they struggled with what they would be doing. Tell me a bit about that, about how some of these volunteers just would struggle and argue with the experimenter when they were asked to administer high doses.
This was something Milgram noticed and wrote about in the first ever journal article as well, that people bargained and pleaded with the experimenter. They stuttered, they sweated, they groaned. They were agonising about what they were being asked to do. So there were clear sort of physical symptoms, if you like, of their distress and their struggle with their conscience about what was happening.
What do we need to bear in mind, too, about the context of this whole thing? This is Yale University. It's a distinguished Ivy League university. What do you think was kind of going through the minds of some of these volunteers, often in middle-class, working-class professions, going into this university?
A lot of the subjects hadn't been inside the university before, which is quite extraordinary given that Yale dominates the town of New Haven. It's a huge campus. So I think there was an element, certainly, of people feeling that when they came into the experiment that Yale wouldn't ask them to do something that was harmful, that they were there for a scientific experiment and therefore it was a benign thing that they were involved in. In fact, people talked about the fact that they volunteered for altruistic reasons. It was the period of the Cold War, the space race, that whole view about science and the pursuit of science being a patriotic duty.
Is there a sense in which it could be said that these volunteers, they were doing something not so much that they thought they had to do, but what they ought to do?
Totally. That's my belief. I think that a lot of people came to that experiment and believed, even though they were asked to do something that they thought was terrible, they didn't really believe that Yale would put them in a situation where they would be harming someone, but also that if Yale asked them to do something, it must be for a good reason. So they invested a lot in the experiment that we're not aware of or haven't been aware of.
That brings up to my mind, another story, though, the famous story about Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS during the Second World War, when SS men were asked to just simply gun down groups of Jewish people with machine guns, and they showed evident distress at having done so. And he roused them by saying, you can't just ask our men to do this. They must be inspired. They must be told this is an awful duty, but you're doing it for the greater glory of Germany. You're doing it for the Reich. You're ridding the world of this thing. There's a higher cause here. Maybe this still just confirms his conclusions, though, nonetheless. People are intimidated by institutions and people, and when they're given a higher good.
It does, but Milgram was wary of drawing that parallel too much because he wanted to indicate that Yale didn't have as much of an influence in that way, that if he conducted the experiments somewhere else, he would get similar levels of obedience.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online and podcast.
Conversations coming to you live today from the Brisbane Writers Festival at the State Library of Queensland in South Bank with Gina Perry, who is the author of Behind the Shock Machine, the untold story of the notorious Milgram psychology experiments. Now, you said the main thing that really got you, the question that you wanted to answer was what happened to those people who had volunteered for this and the ones that discovered that they were essentially no better than Nazi guards. What happened to them, indeed? They were kind of debriefed, as you said. They were told, oh, it wasn't so bad, the machine wasn't that terrible. Once you found people, how did they say they felt after they'd walked out of that experiment and administered a lethal dose?
Well, the first person that I interviewed who went to 450 volts, Bill Menold, told me that he drove home that night to his home, which was a little town outside of New Haven, and went straight to his neighbour's house, who was an electrician. And he went straight to his neighbour and said, this is what I've just done. Can you tell me, what have I done to that man? What would 450 volts do to someone? And his neighbour reassured him that he couldn't possibly have done what he'd been told that he'd been doing with 450 volts. So people left the lab very unclear about what had just happened, and people were very distressed. All the people I spoke to were not debriefed in the sense that we understand it today. They left the lab believing that they'd shocked a man. They'd left a lab believing the machine was real, and they left a lab feeling, not surprisingly, very distressed about what they'd done. And that applied to people who broke off, not just people who went to 450 volts. There were people I spoke to who still felt very distressed that they'd even started the experiment.
Was Milgram ever troubled by this?
Publicly, no. Privately, yes. So in his papers, he does agonise at times about what he put people through. And I remember there's one note that he wrote to himself saying that he felt that it was really pushing the boundaries about ethically about what you should and shouldn't do with human subjects. But publicly, the moment the controversy started about his experiments, he defended himself, you know, consistently, and that no self-doubt crept into that.
You met with a guy called Herb Weiner, which is a very American name. What was his experience as a test subject?
Well, Herb Weiner, funnily enough, should never have got into the experiment in the first place, because Milgram had an assistant, and the assistant's job was to screen out anybody who worked for Yale. And Herb Weiner got through the cracks, and he worked as a forestry professor at Yale. So he actually confronted Milgram after the experiment. He rang Milgram in his office and told him in no uncertain terms that he wanted to come and meet with him and talk about what he'd just been put through.
Was he furious?
Furious. And he said he felt one benefit that he had over all the other Milgram subjects was because he was a professor at Yale, and he and Milgram were around the same age, and they were definitely both assistant professors, that he had an advantage, and he was able to stand up to Milgram and talk about what he felt.
And what was Milgram's response to all this? And where did it go from there?
Milgram, I think, was very clever with people who complained about the experiment or who really were furious about what had happened. He took them into his confidence and told them the real purpose of the experiment, and kept them up to date with his research findings so that people felt included and quite, in a strange way, loyal. Herb Wiener still feels very conflicted both by the experiment and what he went through, but also this personal relationship that he had with Milgram, where they met regularly for lunch and they talked about Milgram's research. So Milgram was very good at defusing potential complaints and criticism.
He called that process debriefing at the end, but it's not debriefing at all, is it? It's just revealing the ruse, the hoax. Did he do it all the time? Were all the test subjects told that it was a ruse?
His use of the word debriefing was to tell them another lie. So the people, there were a proportion of people who were told the truth, but Milgram really didn't want people to know what was happening in the experiment because New Haven is a small town, and he felt that if he told people what the experiment was really about, he'd find it more difficult to get people coming along who hadn't heard of it. A bit like today, most people have heard of the Milgram experiment in this room. So,
were people? Do you think people were better off for not being told what they'd really been part of?
I think it completely underestimates people to tell them another lie. And how can you make someone feel better about what they've just done when they've been engaged in an experiment like that? It's a very patronising view of your subjects, who are real people, to think that you can kind of pat them on the head and tell them it's all fine, you just did what a nurse would do, go home and don't worry about it. That was the bit that really troubled me, I think.
The sense Milgram was playing dollies with human beings here?
Totally, yes. I think that was a tradition. I don't think it was just Milgram. I think there was definitely a tradition that really was at its peak in that period where humans in experiments, in psychology, social psychology experiments, were almost regarded as raw material. And their points of view weren't sought, their opinions, their feelings were not discussed. All Milgram measured was the number of volts on a machine, a finger on a switch. He didn't ask people what they thought was happening. He didn't talk to them about how they felt afterwards. He tried to minimise their distress. Out the door, next in, please.
Gina, how close did you come to becoming a subject of a Milgram-type experiment?
Well, the La Trobe experiments were conducted in the early 70s. I've calculated that I probably missed out on them by about 12 months. But I could have been, if I'd been there a year earlier at La Trobe, it would have been an expectation for me as a first-year student to conduct a Milgram experiment with another student using people we knew at La Trobe. We would have had a little caravan there at La Trobe that was completely fitted out with the shock machine, the mirror, the microphones, the works. So, yeah, I think I came really close.
The Milgram experiments were in, the results were published. Why did La Trobe University think it had to do its own set of experiments?
It was still seen then, I think, as part of a psychologist's professional training to have these things in your toolkit, really, these skills of running experiments, of using deception, of setting up these almost theatrical experiments where you're covertly observing people. That would have been seen as an important part of psychological training at that time.
You met with Diane, who was a woman who had taken part as a subject of one of these Milgram-type experiments at La Trobe University. She went on to become a secondary school teacher, even taught Holocaust literature to Year 12 students. How did she recall her experience as a test subject for a Milgram-type experiment at La Trobe?
It was a very uncomfortable interview for me because she was very distressed remembering it. And
well, 40 she, years later, 30,
absolutely,
40 years later.
Yes, it's something that she felt very ashamed of at that time. It was something that she'd kept very secret, and it was a part of herself that she described as something that she just hated to think about, that she really did regard herself as no better than a Nazi. And so she said, she described teaching Holocaust literature and the situation that that put her in with students, where she felt that she could identify herself as being someone with that potential, and that was very difficult for her.
How did she recall being recruited for the experiment?
Well, she was recruited by someone she knew in college at La Trobe who said that she was at risk of being thrown out of the psych department and failing her course unless she could get a subject for an experiment, and would Diane help her do it?
Well, that was a lie though, wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
So a friend brought her into it. If Diane was the teacher, who was the learner in this case? Was it the friend?
Yes.
But that makes no sense as an experiment then. I mean, that's a different kind of experiment, isn't it?
Well, in theory it is, but I think what's ironic about that is that Milgram conducted one very similar, where he used pairs of relatives and pairs of friends in one of his variations. But yes, it's a completely different experiment, but it's using emotional blackmail as well. What's right and what's wrong in that experiment? When someone's crying out and telling you, keep going, even though I'm in pain, I'll get thrown out of uni if you don't keep going. How do you decide in that situation which way you should be going?
How did she feel afterwards, after she'd walked out of that little...
Humiliated, very, very angry. She felt that the students running the experiment didn't really understand how she felt about having been put through that. And certainly other students I've talked to who conducted the experiment at La Trobe have talked too about how they were very ill-prepared for what they were putting their friends and acquaintances through as subjects.
So why did they do it? Why did they actually ask their friends and acquaintances to do this?
Well, it was a requirement of their first year at uni and it was part of their assessment. So they didn't have a lot of choice. I did meet one person who did resist, who said that she wouldn't conduct the experiment because she thought it was cruel. But
this is a Milgram experiment all of its own then.
Yes.
So they were coerced. They were being obedient in agreeing to conduct the experiment.
Yes. So
they were following orders.
They were following orders, yes.
God, that's creepy, Gina. How do they feel about it now, what they've done and the way they made people feel?
I think most of the ones I spoke to obviously felt that it was a unfair thing that they were asked to do, and I think most of them feel quite troubled that they agreed to go through with it. And I know one person in particular who felt that he lost a friendship over it, and I'm sure there are others. I think it would be very hard to maintain a friendship with someone when you've put them through that. It's such a betrayal of trust.
What about the man who ran the course at La Trobe? What did he say? Does he still feel okay about doing these experiments?
He feels very strongly that this is good training for psychology graduates. He also was of the belief that there was a good lesson there for people who took part in the experiments, because they would learn that in later life, if they came into situations where they were being pressured to do something against their will, they'd have the wherewithal to be able to resist. So he really felt that it was a lesson for people that they could use in a constructive way.
Like they were traumatised into some kind of scepticism about following orders. Is that how you'd see it?
That's certainly how Milgram put it as well. He felt that what people learned about themselves was an important lesson that they could carry into other areas of their life. I don't think that's something that they volunteered for. Someone called it inflicted insight. That is, you learn something about yourself in the experiment that you didn't volunteer for and that you didn't agree to take part in. So what you do with that self-knowledge once you've been through an experience like that, I don't think it is nearly as simple or straightforward or glib as the fact that you will resist authority next time round. I think, like
no
Diane...
No need to thank me, yes, yes.
Like Diane and others, people feel that they have a shameful, evil part of themselves that they were forced into or pushed into experiencing.
There were several nuns who took part in the La Trobe experiment. How did they go?
I've only heard about the nuns anecdotally, but my understanding is that people were quite surprised that some of the nuns, one in particular, went to 450 volts. I certainly understood from that staff and students really began then to talk about the implications of running this experiment. I've also since heard that there was a bit of a campaign at La Trobe with students putting up posters on the wall to discourage others from taking part in the experiment as a result. So there was quite a bit of disquiet amongst the student body. Who knows whether or not it was the nun that was the tipping point, but certainly people did resist after a while in terms of agreeing to go ahead with the experiment.
Nuns in those days particularly, they were brought up to everything about their life was to follow the orders from the male authority figure within the church, wasn't it? I wonder if it's that surprising, really. You do as the man in the uniform tells you what to do.
Well, I think we have exactly the same situation too. You're in a university. It is your lecturer who you respect, who has a very good reputation. It's a new university. You're expected to do this as part of your course. There's nothing there that is saying that this is wrong. All the message you're getting is this is required of you and you will be penalised if you don't do it, if it's part of your undergraduate training.
All of this would seem to strengthen Milgram's conclusions that people will follow orders from authority figures and in spite of what seems to be right in front of their nose. But you found out evidence to show there's much more to the story than that. Now, I've seen the videos of the Milgram experiments from the 1960s that are taken, and it looks compelling and dramatic. But what did you find out about how many people actually believed what was going on?
Well, as I said earlier, people weren't asked what they felt or thought during the experiment, but afterwards Milgram sent out a questionnaire and got answers back from people about that, and all of that information is in the archives at Yale. What I found in the archives at Yale was that Milgram had done an analysis of his data, and he had analysed the data to look at, in the questionnaire, when people were asked how much did you believe the experiment, that is, did you have any doubts about the fact that it was real, did you suspect it was a hoax, he actually did an analysis of people's levels of obedience against their level of belief. And what he found was, this is unpublished, which I think is interesting, he found that there was a relationship between the fact that people who fully believed the man was being shot were more likely to break off early. People who suspected that the experiment was a setup were more likely to go to maximum voltage. So it's not hard science. It does raise questions, though, about the fact that people were in a very ambiguous situation, and a lot of the notes that people wrote in the questionnaire were things about how they thought at the time. Certainly a proportion of them thought there is something very fishy going on here. Why, on one hand, is a man in a lab coat telling me in a very calm manner to keep continuing when there's a man screaming in the room next door? There's something weird about that. Another man noticed that he could hear the learner's voice coming from a speaker above a door rather than where he would expect it to be coming from, because at that point they were using tape recordings. So there were elements of the experiment that were, to some people, quite clearly unusual or fishy.
Does that mean that 65% figure is, in technical terms, crap?
Highly, highly questionable. Of those 65%, we have to allow for the fact that a definite proportion of people had suspicions that the man was not being shot. But this is excluded from the official story of the Milgram experiments, because once you introduce that element, once you acknowledge that there were subjects in the Milgram experiments who had doubts about it, it's like a house of cards.
Do you get a sense that Milgram had reached his conclusions before he'd started the experiments?
Yes. I think even as early as his initial applications for funding, he was making the parallel between Nazi Germany and subjects in a lab. And the first journal article was about the first 40 subjects, so the first condition of 24, and he mentioned the concentration camps in that first journal article. He really did see what he was doing in the lab through that particular lens, or wearing those particular blinkers, as I like to think about it. And I felt that he shoehorned the results that he found into a theory that doesn't fit.
Is it drawing a longbow to suggest that he thought the point was to deliver a warning and he would make the results suit that warning? The warning was that it wasn't just Nazi Germany, it could happen anywhere. Because I think at one point he does say it could happen in any American town. You could find these camp guards and train drivers. You could find people to do this in any American town. Do you think the point was for him to make that warning?
Partly, but I also think that at that time and at that point in his career, there was enormous pressure on him to come up with a research program that would deliver counterintuitive or surprising results. I think the same pressure's on psychological research today. It's not news unless it tells us something new or surprising or novel. And he was very aware of that. And what was new or surprising or novel was the fact that he supposedly found this same behaviour in America that until that point had been very much regarded as a German characteristic, that it was a characteristic of German personality and culture and society that had produced the Holocaust. Milgram's research seemed to be saying, well, no, actually, it's the power of the situation that you're in rather than your upbringing, your culture, your nationality. It's much broader than that. So I think there was element of it there, the moral warning, but also the ambition and the desire to make a mark and make an important, what he felt was an important statement.
It's been replicated many times, hasn't it, this experiment? I wonder if people are attracted to the drama of it rather than the science. They're attracted also maybe to that moment of the sanctimonious aha, we've just shown you up as a moral monster. What do you think?
I think that's the absolute fascination. That's why we're here.
That's why you got
about
interested.
Milgram.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's why I'm interested.
Yes,
yes.
It seems to provide a kind of ready, glib answer in a way, and it seems to provide some insight into human nature. And yes, people repeat it continuously, and it's now actually moved into the realm of reality TV. We have TV shows now that use the Milgram experiment. There's a recent French game show where people had contestants who would win money if they gave electric shocks to someone else. So it's come full circle. We've gone back to candid camera.
In fact, there was a US TV network that tried to replicate it, where it wouldn't go to the lethal dose point, and they made their own shock machine, but they had to make it for the 2000s. You had a look at it. They let you have a go at it, too. What was it like? Tell me about the experience.
It was very strange, because I sat in front of the machine, and it did look very similar to the original, although it had looked a little bit more updated. It didn't look as clunky, but it was stainless steel. It had the buzzers. It had the lights. And because of our technological advances since the 1960s, when I pressed a switch, it actually had a computer that would give me the response. So I would hear the learner's cries. It was generated that way.
You pressed a button and you'd hear a scream?
Yes, yes.
Like what kind of a scream? Like a dear God, no, like a full-throated scream?
Well, the disturbing thing for me was that when I visited that day, the computer had been not working properly, and when I pressed the first switch, which I fully expected to be silent, I got someone screaming, let me out, my heart's bothering me. So I nearly fell out of my chair.
Maybe that's a better indication of what messed up people, human beings are. That we'd actually make such a machine, that would do such a thing? You'd press a button and it would scream at you, let me out, my heart's having trouble. If someone obeyed at that moment, obeyed the instruction that they were given, that doesn't mean they'd always obey it, does it? At that moment in time. It doesn't mean that they'd do it 10 years down the track, 5 years, 10 years down the track.
They obeyed for 45 minutes in a lab in 1961 and 1962. But we still talk about them. They're still referred to in textbooks as people who, yes, would obey that way forevermore, like they're fixed, like a butterfly on a pin. It's a very strange conclusion to come to.
Do you think you could have done it? Do you think you could have been hoaxed into it as a young woman particularly?
If I wasn't a psychology student, probably, yes. I think you're particularly vulnerable at particular points in your life. I think the female subjects that Milgram ran through that experiment were doubly disadvantaged because it was the 60s and you had all the gender issues there with a male experimenter as well. So Yeah, I'm not confident I wouldn't have obeyed at that time either.
Can I ask the audience to honestly reflect upon this? Do you think you could have been hoaxed into administering a lethal dose of electricity as a young person, for example? Put your hand up if you think you could. I actually think it's entirely possible. A couple of hands shot up for half a second and back down again, I think. Well, that's an interesting phenomenon all of itself. Do you think, despite all this, Gina, that the Milgram experiments still have important information for us?
They do, but I don't think they're about obedience to authority. I think they're about people's faith in experts, their trust in science. So I do feel uncomfortable these days talking about the Milgram experiment and those subjects in the same breath as Nazism, because I really don't believe in that connection. I think they've been extremely hard done by ever since the experiments were conducted, and the people at La Trobe as well. I think, yes, the experiments have got a lot to tell us about our own views of science and our own lack of scepticism, I think. I think we should question the stories that we're told, and we've been told this story over and over. It's churned out in textbooks every year, and I think we should question what it is it tells us. I think we should ask why we don't hear the subject's stories, why we don't hear about data that was never published, why Milgram kept secret experiments quiet. These things, I think, are very revealing, and realise it was a much more complex and nuanced situation that's still fascinating, but for completely different reasons.
I love it when at the end of the program it sort of comes to a point, because it's radio. It seems to be that the point you're making is don't obey the story of the Milgram experiments.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Gina Perry. Gina Perry is the author of Behind the Shock Machine, the untold story of the notorious Milgram psychology experiments.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.